I'm considering inviting Hamas in to do a revenge attack. Anyway, my son, tonight's lecture is supposed to be reading readiness, preparation for dealing with Jewish texts. I want to tell you some things that are obvious, but they're also very widely misunderstood as just an introduction. A text is part of a culture. A text doesn't exist by itself. It didn't grow out of the ground like a mushroom. Somebody wrote it. Somebody wrote it for other people to read in a culture where books and reading have a certain function. Indeed, maybe functions. Different functions. And that means that how you interpret a text is relative to the purposes that the text fulfills in the terms of the culture. So, for example, if someone took Macbeth, I won't presume that you've heard of Shakespeare's most famous play. If someone took Macbeth and read it for an account of Danish history, it would be a big flop. After all, there was nobody named Macbeth, and there were those events that are described there didn't happen. But of course, Shakespeare wasn't trying to write history. He was trying to write something about human nature and about culture, or maybe about history in general, but not about the particular history of Denmark in the period in which he set his story. So, texts are relative to the cultures that produce them and to the purposes they have for that production. Now, there are people, of which there are a few sitting here, when they hear the word relative, that sets off a bell in their minds. Okay, so there are no standards of right and wrong. Nothing's valid or invalid. Nothing's true or false. Everything's what you like. It's all subjective. I would like you to know that that's just not correct. It's not correct for text. It's not correct for ethics. It's not correct for mathematics or anything else. Relative does not mean that it's all play. I'll give you an example. Which side of the street is the correct one upon which you should drive? That's relative. In England, it's hard to say this without laughing, they drive on the left-hand side of the street. Could you imagine that? In America, they drive on the right-hand side of the street, so it's relative. But now, take your car onto the right-hand side of an English street, and when the bobby, that's what they call their local friendly policeman, pulls you over to give you a ticket, tell him, listen, which side you drive is relative. It's relative, it's subjective, and it's all dependent upon what you feel and what you think and how you see the world. I don't think you'll get very far. Because once you're in England, then it's absolute. That the left side is the only correct side to drive on. So to say something's relative only means fill in what it's relative to, and then it becomes absolute. So, if someone writes the history of Denmark, published by Cambridge University Press in their history series, and he makes up false events about Denmark, and when they criticize, he says, well, listen, Shakespeare got away with it, so why can't I get away with it? The answer will be, well, there is literature, there are plays, and they have a certain type of function in the culture, and then there are history books. And you wrote a history book. You didn't write a literature book. So once you've stuck yourself into the relative square of history, then we expect you to tell the truth. The literal truth about the events. Names, places, dates. So when I say that interpreting a text is relative to the purposes of the text, I don't thereby mean to say that interpretation is free play. What I mean to say is, You've got to study the culture and figure out what purposes the text served in the culture, and then you know what standards to apply. And then you apply the standards, and the text can come out good or bad. 1% good and 99% bad. And that's how they are classified. Second of all, when you say it's a matter of interpretation, in many people's minds, including I'm sure some people sitting here, that rings the same bell. Oh, it's a matter of interpretation. And you know what that means. It's free play. Anybody can interpret anything any way he wants, and there's no standards, and of course there's nothing true and nothing false, nothing valid, nothing invalid. It's all a matter of interpretation. Now here I have a suggestion for you, and it's a suggestion I will make over and over again during the year. When you hear something like that, something philosophical, try to take it down to an everyday event, an everyday experience that you know well, and you feel you understand well, and you feel that you can really control. Don't conduct the discussion in highfalutin abstract terms that sound like Sartre or other United philosophers. Bring it down to the nitty-gritty of daily life. So, I've signed a contract with you. You're performing certain services, and I've promised to pay you $1,000 a month on the 10th of every month. Okay, January 10th, I come to your office with a little package. And you open it up, and inside there are 1,000 Monopoly dollars. And you say, what's that? And I say, well, the contract says I have to pay you $1,000 a month, so I'm paying you. And you say, listen, you know, this is Monopoly dollars. I said, I know. Where in the contract does it say that you can't use Monopoly dollars? Where did you write that in? You didn't write it in. It says dollars, Snoop. These are dollars. They're Monopoly dollars. Please don't be stupid. You say, it's got to be U.S. dollars. Listen, this Monopoly set was made in the U.S. There's definitely U.S. Monopoly dollars. So, you know, what have you got against me? That's not a joke. It's not even a joke. And it's not open to interpretation, and it depends upon how you see it, and so forth and so on. It's just wrong. Capital W. Indeed, if we couldn't make decisions like that, there couldn't be any contract, there couldn't be any business, there couldn't be any partnerships, there couldn't be any ownership, because all of this depends upon pieces of paper. And these pieces of paper have to say something definite. And if there were no, as so-called deconstructionists pretended, if there were no content to what you say, and it was all a matter of interpretation, then it wouldn't have any fixed meaning. Now, frankly, I'm not going to give you $5 million to open a business if the contract between us has no meaning. If it's all a matter of interpretation. But it isn't like that. You receive a letter from a friend. And in the letter, the person sounds quite hurt at something you did. And you want to know, should I try to make it up to him? Or is it hopeless? You may go to a friend and say, listen, do me a favor, read this letter and tell me what you think. Tell me if you think there's any hope or whether I just have to give up on this person. Now suppose he says, he reads the letter and says, oh, have I got good news for you. This isn't a letter of pain. This is a shopping list. It must have got put in the wrong direction. Look, it says, dear Peter, right? But Peter stands for Sosas. And it says, I never want to hear from you again, means that the outboard motor is broken, and if it's as it is, it can't be used, and it has to be fixed. And it's all a matter of interpretation. I don't think that would be very helpful. I also don't think it would be very accurate. Because words have meanings, and sentences have meanings, and people express themselves with these words and sentences. And knowing people as you do, and knowing the purpose of the writing as you do, there are fixed standards by which you can interpret and get at the meaning of the passage, or meaning of the text. Now, are there disagreements about interpretation? Yes. But let me clue you in. There are disagreements about everything. There are disagreements about physics. I taught philosophy and mathematics. There are disagreements about mathematics. There are disagreements about logic. There are disagreements about everything. That's no reason to throw everything overboard and say that there are no standards and everything's all subjective and it's all a matter of how you feel. Just because there are disagreements. in particular because, in addition to the disagreements there are also, can you guess? Agreements. There are lots of things that are agreed upon. You know, if someone's going to suggest that maybe Macbeth was a transvestite, we're not going to hear him. Because that wasn't in Shakespeare's vocabulary. Because an issue as big as that wouldn't be left to depth interpretation. That would have been the subject of the whole play. And it would have been out in front. Because we know how people talk and we know how they express themselves. So the fact that there are differences and difficulties of interpretation, that's true. There are differences and difficulties in every subject. But there's a vast amount that is agreed upon. There's a vast amount that can be deduced from the text as absolute. And therefore, talking about interpretation as if it were fun and games is just a mistake. Now, God wrote us a book. Let's take the five books of Moses for the moment. What shall we do with it? How shall we interpret it? How shall we use it? What is our attitude for it? What purpose is it designed to serve? Now, I'm going to put this in radical terms. I'm basing myself on Luzzatto's essay on fundamentals. It's printed at the back of The Way of God. I see now, I didn't realize it, Cap translated that as well, which is very good. The last five pages are called the Unwritten Torah. But it's more than that. It's about the nature of the written Torah and interpretation of the whole. And I highly recommend it to all of you to read, I don't know, 8 or 10 times. Because every reading will repay itself handsomely. And this is what Luzzatto says. I have a book. I don't care a fig what the book means. I'm not interested in what the book means. The book is a tool whereby God is communicating to me. God is sending me a message. The book is only a vehicle. It's only a vehicle to send the message. Why would I care what the book means? I don't care what the book means, I care what God means. And here, Rabbi Kaplan mistranslated the passage. He confused kavanah with mashma'ut. Mashma'ut in Hebrew is meaning. Kavanah is intention. And the word that Luzzatto uses over and over again is kavanah. What is God's intention in writing this passage? Now Luzzatto says, God gave us the book, but he gave us rules to decipher his intention. Listen carefully. These are not rules of interpreting the meaning of the text. I don't care about the meaning of the text. What I care about is, what does God want to tell me using this text? Suppose he wrote a rule that said, take every sixth letter and just string them together. Forget all the other letters. Erase them. I don't care. My message is putting every sixth letter together. So then, all I would care about is every sixth letter. The rest of it I wouldn't care about. I wouldn't even read it. Wouldn't pay any attention to it. God gave me a book. He has to tell me what to do with it. Otherwise, I haven't got the foggiest idea what to do with it. Is it supposed to go in the literature series, or the history series, or the mathematics series? Where does it belong? Without knowing the series that it goes to, I don't know how to fill in what it's relative to. I don't know what its purpose is. If I don't know what its purpose is, I don't know how to get anything out of it. But again, what I want to get out of it is what God intends me to know, not what it means. The 13 rules of Rabbi Yishmael that you recite, some of you anyway, recite in the morning prayers. You look at those 13 rules. They are not particularly logical. That's putting it mildly. I mean, they're not logical at all. Even Kal Vachomer, although this is an extended subject, I'm not going to go into it in detail tonight, but you should reflect on the fact that Rabbi Shmuel had to put it in his 13th rule. Why? If that's so logical, if it's just plain, pure, clean logic, why do you have to put it in the rules? We're always using logic. You can't escape using logic. So we should use it without the rules. No, he has to write it down as a rule. Otherwise I couldn't use it.
It's even worse than that, but I'm not going into that now, at the moment. Many, many proofs that the Kal V'chomer is not really logical, even the Kal V'chomer. It's a formal rule. When you have these and these situations, do that. But I wouldn't agree with doing that myself. Because two verses share a common word, that means they have to have a common meaning, or the laws have to be in common. General, particular, particular, general, you could have written this 100 different ways. The only yichus, the only authority that these rules have, says with Sato, is that God revealed them to us when he gave us the book. So there are rules of divining, of determining, of deriving God's intention in communication from the book. Not the meaning of the book. It has nothing to do with the meaning of the book. They're not even rules of interpretation at all. There's no rule of interpretation that says take every sixth letter and string them together. It's not a rule of interpretation. It's just how God may have wanted to present us with the meaning of the book. Now, as a matter of fact, God gave a wide variety of rules there. The 13 that you have in Lishmoel are for deriving laws. Then there are 32, I think, of Rebbe Lezer, which are for deriving agadic status and deriving the information concerning agadic matters. But all of them are simply determining what God's message for us is, what has anything to do with the meaning of the text or not. Now, you have all these methods, and you have all these rules, and you have all these ways of deriving God's intention from the text. As a matter of fact, surprise, surprise, one of them happens to be the literal meaning of the text. It didn't have to be. God could have said, you know, the literal meaning is just irrelevant. Forget it. Like Shakespeare, where the literal meaning of the descriptions, that they're all false, plays no role in understanding the text. We don't even pay attention to that. No one checks the history of the events that Shakespeare wrote about. Nobody cares about that. God could have said, you know, the literal meaning of the text? I'm not interested in that. This year wasn't written for that purpose. It was written for other purposes. As a matter of fact, God says, among the various methods, pshat, which is the literal meaning, is also a way of communicating information that I want you to have. It's one of my intentions in communicating with you. But that doesn't make it any better than any of the others. It doesn't give it any priority over any of the others. So, you'll have pshat, and then you'll have drush. And drush, vis-a-vis the literal meaning, is very fanciful. They say, oh, well, listen, you know, the pshat is what it really means. And drush is, kind of free association, and rabbis making up homilies to keep their people from falling asleep, or maybe putting them to sleep, you know, on Shabbos morning. But that's using pshat as a standard by which to judge all the other methods. That's completely inappropriate. Pshat is no more valid, no more truthful, no more appropriate than any of the other methods. Indeed, we wouldn't have used pshat at all unless God said, listen, I want you to know, pshat also helps you understand something that I want to communicate to you. But nothing more than that. This has an immediate application, and Lutzato mentioned this, to your study of Talmud. Very often, the Talmud will ask, where does such a law come from? And it will cite a verse. And it will explain how the law is related to the verse. And it makes you very uneasy. Very uneasy. Because the relationship seems to be very loose. Very loose, almost fanciful. It certainly doesn't seem logical. There doesn't seem to be any proof whatsoever that the verse has meaning that law. Sato says, that's because it isn't the proof. It isn't the proof. It isn't the derivation. It's not logical. It's rather an association based on hints. It's association based on hints. And this is what I mean. You know, when you take exams, most of the time, there's a question, you have to give an answer. Sometimes you get a matching question. Ah, you look at that matching question, it's Baruch Hashem. Mm-hmm. Now I'm in good shape. Because I got 10 over here and 10 over there, and I don't have to figure out what it is. I have to pick one of the 10 that's closest. That's much easier. Especially since as you go down the list, you know, by process of elimination, you can, toward the end, the last three or four just answer themselves. So you think, oh, I got a matching question, much easier. Correct. Now, the vast majority of the laws of which the Talmud says, where do we get them from verses, the Talmud, the oral tradition, possessed these laws going all the way back. Moses taught the laws orally all the way back. The question was not how to derive the law from the verse. It's a matching problem. On the one hand, I have the book. On the other hand, I have the laws. My job is only to match them. And the matching can be based on process elimination or on, if I've got to match them up, some aspect of the verse, some aspect which seems relevant to the law, but it's not a logical derivation at all. Here's an example. There's a verse that says that a person commits a certain sort of crime, it gets capital punishment, and the words used in the Torah are yumas hameis, which means the dead person shall die. Right. The dead person shall die. Gosh, doesn't sound very threatening, does it? I mean, if he's already dead. No. So, okay, but it means he should be executed. Now, what does it mean by saying it, the dead person shall die? So, the Talmud says, we have a law. The law says that if a person is committing a crime, a capital crime, there has to be witnesses, and he has to be warned. Someone has to say to him, you're going to swing for that. Well, okay, we don't have to kill people by hanging, but you're going to die for this, committing a capital crime. And he has to say, I know, I'm doing it anyway. I'm doing it anyway. In other words, he has to accept the fact that he'll be killed for this. So the Gemara says, "Achiyatiras atzmolamisa," until he frees himself for death, because he's got to agree to his own death because of this crime. So the Talmud says that's what it means. Yomus hameis, the dead man shall die. He's dead in the sense that he freed himself to die. He agreed to it. That's the person that shall die. Now, listen. You could take those words, yumas hameis, the dead person shall die, and you could analyze them from now until the Messiah comes with supercomputers. You will never get that meaning out of it. You'll never be able to deduce that from it. Because it's not deduced. That's not the point. You're not proving it. The law is valid because Moses taught it as part of the oral tradition. But it is a requirement of Jewish scholarship to relate laws to verses, to connect them through the matching process. That's part of Jewish scholarship. And therefore, the rabbis looked for verses which were, could be regarded as a hint to this particular idea. But if he didn't have the idea already on hand, in the oral tradition, he never would have dreamt of it as an interpretation of the verse. Rav Joshua Fuller Hirsch says exactly the same thing. Now, Lusato proves this by citing a certain style of argument that you have in the Talmud very often. The style of argument is this. You have two scholars, A and B, and they're looking for the source of a law. One says he gets it from verse 1, and the other says he gets it from verse 2. So, one says to the other, well, if you get it from verse 1, what do you learn from verse 2? A different law. It says to him, well, if you get it from verse 2, what do you get from verse 1? A different law. Then they ask each one, well, how are you going to get a derivation for his law? You've used up the verse already. And he says, I got another verse. Okay, you got another verse. Now you ask the other guy, well, okay, you don't need that other verse. So what do you do with that other verse? What law do you learn from it? So there's a different law. So you get back to this guy and say, okay, now he's learning that other law from this verse. Where are you going to learn it from? So you keep forcing them, in their initial disagreement, keep forcing them to work out that everybody's got to have a law for a verse and a verse for a law. And you keep asking them what their matchings are. Now, says Lusato, in logic, you could have stopped the whole discussion at the first stage. This one learns it from verse 1, and this one learns it from verse 2. Right? And the other guy says, I learned another law from that verse. When you say to this one, where do you learn it from? He could say, what do you mean? I don't learn it. What makes you think I learned it? I don't agree with that law. That's why I use the first minutes law, because I don't agree with that law. That's why. End of story. Why do you ask me where the next one's coming from? It doesn't have to come from anywhere. I just disagree. Now you have that sometimes. Sometimes it stops at stage two. Each one says, I disagree with your law, and that's the end of it. But very often it doesn't stop there. The matchings go down, all the way down, until someone says, well, I got it because it's a double word in the verse. The other one says, the double word in the verse is meaningful to me. And that's where it stops. But you have like nine matchings all the way down. Why? Says Rosato, because in that kind of discussion, everybody had the same list of laws, and everybody had the same list of verses, and the only disagreement was, how do you match them up? That was the only subject of the discussion. If it's only how you match them up, then none of them is derivations. None of them is proofs. So when you read, and the Gemara says, Minayin, where is that from? And you get this very fanciful discussion, and most people, you know, either they say, huh, that's the Talmud? I'm getting a cheeseburger. Or they sort of sit there embarrassed and say, well, you know, this is Talmudic logic. By which they mean, it's not really logical, but I gotta say it's logical, so I'll call it Talmudic logic. And everybody feels very uncomfortable. If you know at the outset that it wasn't designed to be logical, you wouldn't have that problem. Here's an example, which some of you know. George's ox gores Peter's ox and kills him. Nasty business. Okay, what to do? The Torah says, sell the live ox, sell the dead ox, and let the two of them split the money. That's what you do. Now let's see. Suppose the two live oxen each cost $2,000. And the carcass cost $200. So how much did the victim lose? $1,800. Okay, now, they're going to sell the two of them. That gives you a total of how much money? $2,200, and then they're going to split. So each one's going to end up with $1,100. How much is the victim getting paid from the split? Think carefully. Huh? Right. $900, because he had the 200 carcass that belongs to him already. He's not getting $1,100 from the split. He's giving up the 200 carcass that he had. So he's getting $900 from the split, right? How is 900 related to 1800? It's half. That's how you learn the law of chatzi nezek, half nezek, that you pay half the damages, which maybe some of you have heard. For a short tub, for an animal that's not, doesn't have a long goring history, you pay half damages. Okay? But of course, I made an assumption, didn't I? What did I assume? That they were worth the same amount of money. Let's try it if they're not worth the same amount of money. Let's suppose that the goring ox is worth $5,000 and the killed ox, while alive, was worth $1,000. And the carcass is worth $200. So when they split, they're each going to get $2,600, right? $2,600. This guy lost, the victim lost how much? No, he had the 200 carcass. He lost 800, he's going to walk away with 2,600. Is that right? Doesn't sound right to me. Shouldn't get more than the whole value of the axe that he lost. And vice versa, it works just as bad. So we say, well, of course, the Torah was talking about a case where the oxen were worth the same amount of money. But it doesn't say that. And Tosfos actually says there's no way to see that as the pshat in the verse. Nowhere in the verse is there any indication that it's just logical. But you have to fill in the logic in order to understand what the verse is talking about. It's not in the verse. It's not written in the verse or hinted at in the verse. So we're not doing strictly literal analysis or proof from the verses. We're doing matching, or we're using external logic or external information. And therefore, if you're looking for a proof from a verse of a law, it happens, but it's rare. Most of the time, it's just a question of matching. Okay. Now let me give you an illustration of how this works. A famous illustration. The very first verse in the Torah is, what can I say? It contains within it a contradiction of plain grammar. It's just not grammatically right. It's only six words long. I mean, how short can you get? And yet it has a mistake in it. Grammatical mistake. What is the correct translation of Bereshis?
The beginning of.
Thus speaks a scholar. Yeah, but you're leading off the final tough. He said it right. It's in the beginning of. Reshis means beginning of. Reshis ha-Mishchak, the beginning of the game. Reshis ha-Sefer, the beginning of the book, the beginning of. Bereshis means in the beginning of. It's what's called a smichut form in Hebrew, a construct form. Okay, so the literal translation of the first two words of the Torah are in the beginning of created. Let's put in the subject. In the beginning of God created. Now, that's just not right. You can't say that. Because after of has to come a little grammar. A noun. Place, person, thing, you know. Object. The beginning of. In the beginning of the 20th century. The beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. You know, the beginning of something. What to do? How can you answer that? Analyze that. Now let me tell you what Rashi says. Rashi, you know, if a person writes a book and it's based on a method, you expect the author somewhere to tell you what his method is. Well, in his second comment on the Torah, Rashi goes through a case in great detail, this case, and in it he shows you what his method is. And from that case you can infer how he does his method in the rest of his commentary. Now listen carefully. The first thing Rashi says is the rabbis interpreted it as follows. Reshis could be regarded as a code word for the Torah or for the Jewish people, based on verses later in the Tanakh. And therefore, it should be read as follows. Beis, for the sake of. Reshis, Torah for the Jewish people. Bara Elohim, God created the heavens and the earth. That's grammatically okay. By the way, Beis can mean for the sake of, even in Pshat. Even in the book of Genesis. I have a parallel verse if you want, but I'll give it. So here's the idea. Beis, for the sake of. Reshis, that's a code word for the Jewish people or for the Torah. For the sake of the Torah of the Jewish people, God created the heavens and the earth. Now it reads terrific. And then Rashi says, and if you want to explain it according to its pshat, you have to do something entirely different. So Rashi says, this is what the rabbis commented, but it's not pshat. And I, says Rashi, I'm coming to do pshat. That's what I'm doing. Why does he mention the rabbis first? Because what the rabbis are doing is not wrong. It's not fantasy. It's not inaccurate. It's not invalid. It's true, valid, important, holy, correct, eternal. It's just not pshat. It's God's communication through this verse, but based on a different way of reading God's intention according to the rules that he gave us. But Rashi is saying, there's also pshat. God also told us that pshat is important. I'm coming to explain the pshat. And here's how Rashi explains it. He says, I would have you read bara as if it were written bara. Same letters. Bara is a gerund. It's creating. And you read it like this. In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth. Creating is a process. Creating is a noun. You could say, creating is hard work. Creating is fun. Creating can be the subject of a sentence. The name of a thing, in this case, a process. In the beginning of creating the heavens and the earth. That's what Rashi suggests. Now Rashi says, of course. This is not JTS, you know, and it's not HUC. It isn't written Baro, it's written Bara. We don't rewrite the letters and rewrite the words and pretend it's Chaldean or Akkadian. It's not all that kind of fantasy. But there's an exact parallel. In the second verse of the book of Hosea, there, the book says, Techilas Diber Hashem Behoshea. Now, Techilas means, oh, good, somebody caught it right away, at the beginning of, that's what the top at the end is saying. Not Techila, but Techilas. And then after comes Diber, what does Diber mean? Spoke. So there you have the same problem. In the beginning of, God spoke. Now there, it's clear, it's the beginning of the book of Hosea. It's the beginning of God's speech to Hosea. So it clearly means, in the beginning of God speaking to Hosea. So Rashi says, this is a biblical idiom where you have a construct, beginning of, and then a verb. The verb is meant to be understood as a gerund. Not did, but doing. Now Rashi says, this is very important. Rashi says, I know you won't agree with me. The critic won't agree with me. So Rashi imagines a critic who's going to argue with him. When Rashi does that, what he's telling us is, pshat is something you have to prove. And you can have a critic. And if he has good arguments, you have to give up. So pshat is not based on authority, it's not based on history, the rabbi said so. No. You create a pshat, you have to defend it. And if somebody can show you that there's something wrong with it logically, then you have to give it up. So Rashi says, the critic will object. Why do it that way? There's a much simpler, much more natural way to do it. In the beginning of, leaves a blank. In the beginning of blank, God created the heavens and the earth. Don't turn it into a gerund. Leave it as a verb, the way it's written and the way it's pronounced. But we have many verses in the Tanakh which have blanks. And you're supposed to fill in the blank. You're supposed to fill it in intelligently, just on the basis of the context of the meaning that's intended. And we would suggest, says the critic, that you stick in the word everything. You start in the beginning of the book. The beginning of the book is the beginning of creation. So say, in the beginning of everything, God created the heavens and the earth. And the critic says, Rashi writes that out, he brings five verses from all over the Tanakh, which have holes in them, just like this, and one of them is based on the exact same words. There's a verse that says, Magid Mereshis Acharis, which literally translated means God declares from the beginning of the end of. Thank you very much. He declares from the beginning of the end of. Beginning of what? End of what? Doesn't say. Beginning of the end of. So says the critic, obviously you're supposed to fill in. Either from the beginning of everything, the end of everything, or the beginning of each thing, the end of each thing. Obviously that's what you're supposed to fill in. So if you know that the Tanakh has this style, that it leaves holes, and it expects you to fill them in, and it even has holes with the same word, the exact same word, why not fill in the obvious thing for that word? It's the beginning of everything. So what is the critic doing? Number one, he's using logic. Number two, he's using comparative text. If you want to prove what it means over here, you're allowed to use verses elsewhere. As long as they're parallel, as long as the words are the same, or the meaning is the same, you're allowed to use them, and you have to use them as... So Rashi used a verse from Hosea. The critic used five verses from all over, including a word with the same, a verse with the same word. So Rashi says, if that's what you think, that's the way you're going to interpret it, the beginning of everything, God created the heavens and the earth, then you should be astonished at yourself. You've made an elementary error. The elementary error is that in the next verse it says, the earth was formless and void, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters, darkness is on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters. Well, the second verse mentions the waters. When did they come in? Oret. According to the... Oh, so Oret, as a matter of fact, the next page, means dry land. Oret means dry land. Doesn't mean that. Oret doesn't mean the globe of the earth with all of its content. The Torah explicitly says Oret means dry land. It's a good try. That's what it says. So Rashi says, if you're going to translate in the beginning of everything, God created heavens and the earth, and the next verse makes mention of the waters, you have no explanation where the waters came from. Now it says, Rashi, look at my translation. My translation reads like this.
in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, has anything happened yet? No, this is just stage setting. This is just background. This is where we are. We're at the beginning of the creating of heavens and earth. This was the situation. The Oretz was tohu bavohu, formless and void, and darkness on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Nothing's happened yet. This is just describing where we are. The first thing that happens in verse 3 with the creation of light. The first thing the Torah describes is the creation of light. All the rest of it is background. In other words, as Rashi says explicitly, Genesis picks up in the middle of creation, not at the beginning. It does not start at the beginning. It does not start at time zero. It starts after time zero.
According to Rashi, when does God finish creating that?
At the end of the 6 days. And the Torah says explicitly, Chulu HaShemayim Ba'aretz.
All is included in
that. Right. Now, you might wonder here, isn't creation one of the most fundamental principles of Judaism? Creation out of nothing. According to Rashi, Genesis doesn't say it. Genesis picking up in the middle. It doesn't say. First there was nothing at all, and then God started making things. It doesn't say that. So Rashi is sort of giving up on a very fundamental Jewish principle. Rashi's attitude is, so what? I'm not here to defend the faithful. I'm here to read the book. Because pshat is the literal meaning of the words. That's what it is. And if it doesn't support the principles that you believe in, so you'll find them in verses in Isaiah, and in verses in Ezekiel, or you'll find them in the oral tradition, or you'll find them in the other ways in which God communicated by using this book. But pshat has no preconceived conditions. Pshat has no preconceived commitments. It is what the words say it is. And that's why Rashi says that it doesn't mean anything about the beginning of creation. Even though it would be very nice for the opening of the book to start with the very beginning. But Rashi says, look, that's not what the word says. So this is the idea of pshat. The literal meaning that has to be defended on the basis of logic, on the basis of context, parallel verses in other places, grammar. Without that, you don't have pshat. And with it, you have something which you can defend and you have to defend. If somebody comes along with a better interpretation, you have to give up. That's why he envisions a critic and he answers the critic. But the implication is if he couldn't answer the critic, he'd have to give it up.
So according to the sages, Hashem created the Kodesh of Israel, only the Shemayim and the Aretz and not the water? Was that something that was created already? Rashi, you should have the same question on that.
You're now causing the sages' comment, which is not pshat, to interact with the pshat.
Rashi was asked on the second pasuk on that.
But who says that their mode of interpretation has anything to do with context? Why does it have to fit into the context? Context itself is just another one of those rules which applies when it applies and doesn't apply when it doesn't apply. Yeah.
You have proof from Tanakh where Bereshit is used with a noun in context showing definitively that it's a smichut form?
Sure, Reshit tovu asof, the beginning of his crops. Rashi brings them. Reshis Mamlechus Yehoyakim, the beginning of the kingdom of Yehoyakim. Sure. Yeah.
Do we know what pshat is, or is it basically a machlokes?
Well, as I said at the outset, there are many pshatim which are true and agreed upon, and then there are cases where there are differences of opinion, and there are arguments back and forth, and you have to. Often it's a trade off. This pshat has this advantage, and that pshat has that advantage.
Also, aren't there areas of Tanakh that are basically incomprehensible, like
a
physical description of God?
Okay, this is very, very tricky. If somebody gives you a mushel, so there are two things to understand. Number one, what's in the mushel? And number two, what is the mushel for? So now, Yechezkel gives you this picture. It's not impossible to understand what the picture is about. It's a meaningless picture. It's a picture that doesn't communicate anything. Okay, so what? So there are chariots and the face of the horse, of the cow, and the face of the man, and the talons of the eagle, and you know, okay, I know what those are. I know what eagles are. I know what an ox looks like. But so what? What are they supposed to say? That's where the problem is. The problem is not so much in understanding the mushel that he describes. The question is, what is he trying to communicate? And that's because it is the fundamental principles of the Kabbalah that he's formulating in a particular way, and therefore it's not obvious to the people who are reading it quite right.
So there are areas in that that are meant for us to derive meaning from, but we don't necessarily know what the literal meaning is. Like
correct. That. And here, it's very interesting. When I said before that shot is a part of the communication, it can be a case where you know that the pshat is not the law that you should follow in practice, or the pshat is not the principle that you should act by or accept, and yet it is the pshat in the words. Now, I'll just give you a comment that the Gaon of Vilna made. Traditionally, there are four main methods of reading God's intentions in the text. They're called pshat, remish, drush, and sod, and the acronym is pardes. Pshat is what I've told you. Remish is the most distant, tiny hint possible. Drush is allegorical interpretations. That ratios could mean the Jewish people, and because on basis of other verses, even though in context, literally, it doesn't mean that. And so there's Kabbalistic. So we usually think, shot you can do more or less on your own. I mean, you've got a good head, and you can think carefully and critically, you can come up with a shot. The other three, you need to be specially trained, special method, and much more difficult stuff, and deeper stuff. And it's going up, deeper and deeper. Higher and higher. Said the Gaon, the last step is to see that the other three are in the pshat. Now, I don't know how to do that, frankly. But to understand that they're not divorced. That the levels interact with one another in certain ways. Now, I'm just telling you what he said. So, the pshat itself could have a deeper level. Indeed, one question which I haven't even addressed is, if God wants to tell us, according to Rashi, the gerund, in the beginning of God's creating, why didn't he do it straight? Why did he do it using a verb with a construct, which literally speaking isn't grammatical, and then leaves it to be understood out of the verse, based on the verse in Hosea, I don't know, 800 years later, that's how you should understand it. Why do it that way? Why not say it straight? So I'll tell you what the Gera Rebbe said. When you learn Talmud, you'll find many, many mesechtos, not all, but many mesechtos start in the middle of the discussion. Shabbos. Shabbos starts with carrying the poor man outside and the rich man inside and handing the crosses over and so on. Along in the seventh parak, it gives you the list of all 39 things that you can't do. You know, if I were writing it, I would start with the list. That's the list of all the things. I would discuss them one by one. Wouldn't that be more organized? Wouldn't that be more orderly? You know, kind of set it up in a logical fashion. No, you start in the middle of a complicated, difficult, and Rashi says that carrying is a malacha grua. It's not representative of all the other malachos. It's different, and it's weaker than all the other ones. Why start there? Zochin, we are learning the Daf Yomi. We just finished the Zochin. Shabbat Zvachim deals with the very complicated cases of misidentifying what you're talking about in various ways, what the consequences are. Around Daf Nun Vav, around 56, it says there are six things you have to have in mind when you slaughter the animal. And it starts with making mistakes. And only 56 stopping later does it come to tell you what you're supposed to do. I wouldn't write that way. No, the Khan is better organized in a certain sense in that reason. So I asked this of a very bright, scholarly friend of mine, Avraham Carmel, and he said, the Ger Rebbe, I forget which one it was, wrote, the lesson is that these are Sifrei Limud. These are books that are to be studied. They're not books that are to be read. That's why the first verse of the Torah isn't straightforward either. It's not a reading book. It's a study book. This is not the Jewish answer to the New York Times. Not even to the Wall Street Journal, which is infinitely better in terms of its factual record and its commentary, or the London Times. It is a book that has to be studied. And if you can't put yourself in the frame of mind to study it, you're just not going to get it. Now, I want to give you one little example. It's something that you all know. Those of you who have the blue books, get open to page 17. Look on. This is a little test. If you've heard it from me, don't answer. If you haven't heard it, then you can look at it and try to answer. Adam eats from the tree. So he knows he's naked and he hides. And God manifests himself in the garden. Verse 11. God says to him, who told you that you're naked? Have you eaten of the tree from which I commanded you not to eat? Now look at the man's answer in verse 12 and tell me, what is his answer?
My name is God. Pass the buck.
Pass the buck. To whom?
To God.
Come on, guys. People have said the right answer three times. You got to see it for yourself. Who is he passing the buck to? Even Mark Twain got this wrong. The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. Who is he blaming?
God.
Blaming God. Not blaming her. Everybody thinks he's blaming her. Everybody. Try it on the street. Write home an email to your parents, to your friends. See what they say. Everybody thinks he's blaming God. He's blaming the woman. Why? Because they don't read. I've done this on four continents. I've done this in at least 24 cities. I come to businessmen, I open it up, I say, read it. Who's he blaming? Ah, see that, blaming the woman, all that is wrong with the woman. All I have to say is read it again. They read it. The face goes into shock. Oh, look at that. He's really blaming God. Correct. That's the kind of book that this is. If you read, all sorts of things will jump out at you that you know, you didn't notice before, and the book opens up. It opens up. Chazal, the rabbis say that this shows he was guilty of ingratitude. God gave her to him to be a helper of one kind or another, and now Adam throws it back in his face. Okay, she did influence him to do something wrong, but as you know very well, and as you will tell your children, he told me to do it. Is not a valid excuse. Right? Person has to take responsibility for his own actions. Can't be because somebody else told him to do it. So this is the bottom line. The bottom line is to read and think, and in that way, even on the basis of pshat, you can get golden nuggets out. But always to remember that the other methods of discerning God's intentions and communicating are not any less valid, not any worse than the simple shot of the verses. And that's why I believe Rashi quotes the rabbis first. He first says it's for the sake of the Jewish people, for the sake of the Torah. That's what he says first. And then he says, the embossel of Farsho Kapshuto. That's all he says. And if you're coming to analyze according to the pshat, then you do something else. And by the way, Rashi's pshat here is written in no other place. This is brand new with Rashi. He's not citing anybody. He's not claiming any authority because it goes back to ancient times. None of that. And I want you to know there's a Rashbam, which they don't teach in yeshivas, because it might give people the wrong impression. There's a Rashbam where he says, this Rashbam was one of Rashi's grandchildren. Ha! They're a big family. You get all sorts of trouble. And he writes that he disagreed with Rashi on a particular pshat, at a different pshat. And he says, in general, in Rashi's old age, I fought with him about how he wrote his pshat, and he agreed with me that if he had time, he should make a new commentary. Amazing. Amazing. He doesn't go into detail, and he doesn't explain what the fight was about. He just says, yeah, if you read his commentaries, you can sort of figure out a little bit, I think, what his disagreement and methodology was. But that's the kind of study it is. It's a question of... Now, I'll show you one last thing.
Another Midrash. Lech Lecha. Okay, so God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha. Lech means go, the command. Lecha means yours. Literally, it's a possessive. It really don't mean nothing. Lech Lecha, go yours. Go to you. Go to yourself. It don't mean nothing. So Rashi says, it means go for your good and for your benefit. That's what it means. Says the Ramban to Rashi, Lo Nachon, it's wrong. It's a mistake. This phrase, having a verb and a possessive, is found in a lot of places in the Tanakh. And says the Ramban, you'll try your trick of saying that the possessive means for your good and for your benefit, you'll see that it doesn't work elsewhere. For example, in the Song of Songs, describing the end of the winter in Eretz Israel, it says the rain stopped. And the way it says it is, Hageshem Cholach, Cholach Lo. Same Cholach, same went. Cholach went Lo. For it, says the Ramban to Rashi. Are you going to tell me it means for its good and for its benefit? It just stopped, that's all. It just disappeared. You know, it stopped raining. So the Ramban says, since you can't apply your interpretation over there, you should admit that it doesn't work over here either. Now, the truth is that Rashi wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. So he definitely knew that verse. But what did Rashi mean? Now, I heard this many years ago, and I forget in whose name it was said. But the answer is like this. Rashi is not saying, Lecha, separately, means for your good and for your benefit. That's not what Rashi's saying. Rashi is not explaining Lecha. Rashi is explaining Lech Lecha, the whole phrase. And the proof of it is, when you look at Rashi's quotation, what's called the Dibur HaMashil, the quotation is not Lecha, but Lech Lecha. He quotes both words. And what Rashi is saying is this. When you have a verb and possessive, it always describes an action which is natural to the subject. Something that could be naturally expected for the subject to do. So indeed, in the end of the winter time, come to the spring, stops raining in Eretz Yisrael. That's what happens every year. So yes, halachlo, the geshem, the rain, halachlo, went away, as it naturally does. Now, God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, go! 75 years old. What are most people doing at 75 years old? They retired 10 years ago. They're just counting the multiple dividends on their stocks. You know, there's fishing off the Keys of Florida or something. Right? God says to Abraham, go! I'm not even telling you where you're going. Just go in this direction to a place that I'll tell you as you're down the line someplace. Is that natural? Is that a natural thing to say? Is that an expected thing to say? Doesn't sound like it. So Rashi's problem is that Lech Lecha, the verb and the possessive, should describe an action that's natural to the subject, and yet it seems to be describing an action that's unnatural to the subject. That's what bothers Rashi. That's the extra word, Lecha. He knows that that's a biblical idiom. And what he says is, if you look in the context, God promises him that he'll become a great nation in Israel, which means that's his destiny. That's what he has to become. So for you, Abraham, going wandering at this age of your life is natural for you. Wouldn't be natural for anybody else. Wouldn't be natural for anybody else. But for you, it's natural. Because it's for you, it represents the way in which you're going to develop into what you have to become. This is how pshat is done. This is how subtle it is and how sophisticated it is. And Rashi was the one who really was the first one to write a systematic commentary based on pshat. The Gemara quotes one of the Tanoim who said, I was 16 years old and I didn't know a mikra yotzei midei pshuto. A verse always has an interpretation of pshat. So the commentator said, well, he didn't know those words. He didn't know that principle. I mean, he himself is saying the principle. What he means is, I couldn't do it. You'll ask me what the pshat is.
I wouldn't be able to tell you. Why? Because he was involved with the other methods of learning what God wants him to know. And indeed, the Talmud says several times that heretics challenged the rabbis about the meanings of various verses. And sometimes the rabbi said, I don't know, go to so-and-so. And they say, why should you go to so-and-so? He said, because he lives in a neighborhood with heretics. So he's used to this. He's worked on it because he had to work on it. So he probably knows the answer. I don't know it because I haven't invested in that. Because Pshat was not the first most important method of getting God's intention in the text. It's a method. It's just that we know that it's a method that is universal. Every verse has a Pshat. And therefore, one of the things that we want to know that God communicated to us is the Pshat in the verses of the Torah. Questions?
One clarifying point, sir, earlier. One is that in the Talmud, they don't use the 13 rules to create new laws, or they don't use drush to derive laws.
I'm sorry, let me clarify. I didn't say that. What I said was this. The 13 rules can be used to create new laws, but they're only decoding devices. They're not deductions. They're not interpreting the meaning of the text. They're enabling me to know what God wants to communicate to me from the text. So they will derive new laws, but not by showing you what the text really means. That's not the subject. Rather, the subject is what God wants me to know from the text. The 13 rules give me new laws. When I was talking about the connections, that was another matter. They connect up in different ways. Not through the 13 rules.
But when they disagree about... Don't they not only disagree about what to derive from certain passages and where to derive them, where to match those up, but also they disagree on even the rules themselves on how you derive laws and how you interpret. Don't they even disagree on that in common?
Yes. Yes, sometimes they do. That's true.
So... You also said something about, like, you have to know the source of the book into categories, physics, math, you know.
That's
like,
right.
How do you do that with a divine book, especially where they're always disagreeing on what category does that fall in? There's nothing to compare it to.
You're right. No, the author of the book has to tell me what context to put it into. That's why he gave me these rules, which enabled me to interpret it.
The rules that they disagree about.
Correct. Why shouldn't they disagree? They disagree about. There can be disagreements about anything. There can be disagreements about mathematics. There can be disagreements about the rules as well. But about 13 rules, there's 1.5 disagreements. So it's not as if everything's fluid.
There's a major consequence, though, especially in divine matters of the world. What kind of communication is that?
Well, you know, communication is a two-sided street. You know, if you are teaching 17-year-olds mathematics, and they don't all get 100 on the exam, it might just be because a number of them are not capable of fully understanding the material. The deeper idea here, which maybe you're searching for, God gives the Torah to man. That's a big risk. In fact, it's not even a risk because he knows what's going to happen. Obviously, people are going to make mistakes in understanding it. Because people are only human. They can make mistakes in anything. So when he gives it to us, he's putting it in our jurisdiction with the mistakes that we're going to make. That's what it means as a gift. You know, we don't appreciate often what it means. It means that he made the operation of the Torah in the world dependent upon our understanding and application of it, knowing full well that we're going to make mistakes in doing it. His Torah. But the choice is that, and by the way, there's another way out in terms of religion. When you build a religion, there's another way out. What's the other way out? He's going to give a book. From time to time, God can stick in the ladle and stir the soup. He can tell you, this is, you know, that's not the way to say it. This is the way to say it. That's the Catholic idea of the Pope speaking ex cathedra, that the Pope can speak with God's voice and tell you, this is the right interpretation. Now, logically, that's another way out. But then, you don't have it. You don't really have it. He has it. You can play with it. And if you go too far, he takes away with you from you and does it again. It says that God gave us the Torah as a gift, it means it's ours now. It belongs to us.
That's the famous story that in the Talmud about Lo B'Shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. A voice from heaven cannot determine who's right and who's wrong in a legal proceeding. A voice from heaven, God says, I'm telling you. The answer is, okay, now that you've told me, I know what's right, but I can't use it. Same thing. Said, the Gemara says explicitly, when the Yoliv and Navi will come, he didn't come to change anything in the law.
He tells who's right.
Sorry?
Tell
us who's what?
Tell us who's right.
Absolutely not. No one will listen to him. He has no authority to do that. Unless he uses an argument. And he can convince people. Nothing disqualifies Elijah as a scholar. If he has good arguments, terrific. But the one thing he can't say is, forget your arguments. God told me, that ends it. That he cannot do. He's not allowed to do that. Isaiah, he can come into the Sanhedrin and say, gentlemen, I want to join the discussion. Like anybody else. But he's only like anybody else. He has no special authority because he's a prophet. Prophecy cannot create law. Law comes from Moses and from the understanding of the law that we have later. That's all. Because it belongs to us.
When it comes to Pshat, you say that we use regular logic and laws of interpretation based on context and other precedents. Isn't that making Torah into a generic book of literature in that sense?
I believe that, first of all, your words say it in a limited fashion, isn't it? Making it into sounds like that's all it is, and it is nothing else but. That's certainly not right. But yes, I believe that all of the mechanisms that you use in literature, many of them you find in the Torah, and they are important. They are important to interpret what the Torah is saying. I think the Torah uses what we call literary mechanisms. And those mechanisms are important for us to register. In any way in which human beings can respond sensitively and logically to a communication, the Torah may use on occasion those ways of communicating. After all, doesn't the Torah have poetry in it? Something.
Making God into the Pshat world in a human author.
Why? Why not say you're making God into an author writing for humans? There are people who write children's stories. Does that make the author a child? No, he's writing stories for children. And he will use all of his sophistication and all of his logic to present a story that will have the effect on the children that he wants it to have. Right? So sure, God is writing it for us. It isn't as if he wrote a private diary and we sort of snuck in and got a peek. Right? That it was something he was writing for himself. Indeed, as one of the students said to me earlier today, when somebody writes something, you have to be very careful and ask who he's writing for. And know that it may be you're not getting his real view of things. He's getting the view of things that he could explain to his audience. And it occurred to me years ago that Maimonides did not write a single book for a peer. Every one of his books he wrote for somebody who was incompetent. The Peirush HaMishnayos, the commentary of the Mishnayos, is written for an ignoramus. A person who doesn't know the Aleph's. Certainly doesn't know the ABCs of Torah and doesn't know the ABCs of philosophy. Explain the most basic elementary concepts there. The Mishnah Torah was written to someone who can't derive a law from the Talmud. Mm-hmm. She's not really a master of the Talmud. And the guy that perplexed, he says in the beginning, I wrote it for this student, and he says, you know, you're not really qualified. You didn't study physics. And physics is a prime preparation. And the first 50 chapters of the guy are devoted to showing that God doesn't have a body. Which I wouldn't have thought of as a very important issue that you have to settle, you know, for 50 chapters. Apparently, this reader of his was in doubt, maybe about that, because he took the Midrashim literally, or took the verses literally, and he had to be proven to him that that's not the way to take it. So, there isn't a single place where Maimonides sort of went full power. He just wrote it because it was true. Well, I think that should cause us to be very cautious in trying to understand what the Rambam thought on the basis of reading his works. Yeah,
you said about
because as my words were, it's natural for the subject in the sentence. The subject in the sentence is Abraham.
But that, I mean, that would still be a special occurrence.
Well, a special person will have things that are natural for him that, I mean, you know, the way Einstein did physics was natural for him, or a brain like his, but for me it would be impossible, let alone natural. I mean, why, what's natural for one is unnatural for another. What was his name? The existentialist therapist, Viktor Frankl, who lived through the death camps, said, anyone who behaved naturally in the death camps was sick. In such an abnormal situation, only abnormal reactions are correct.
That is normal.
Yes. So what we would call abnormal is correct and normal under those conditions. Quite right.
But that would mean that there's like a natural benchmark for what's natural.
What's that?
There's like a natural standard for what's natural. There's a standard, because that would mean that whoever was sick, what's natural. Right.
What's why don't we take the words that I said over and over again? I'm talking what's natural to the subject.
Right.
The subject. It says, the Geshem went away and disappeared. That's not natural for you. It's not natural for me. It's not natural for squirrels, but it's natural for the rain. He said, but look, it's not natural for anything else. Correct, we're talking about the rain. And for the rain, it's natural.
Only
say it again?
Only,
but for vast majority of people, not. And for Abraham, definitely, yes. That's what it says. Hare, the verse says, Rashi cites this. The next verse says, Ve'eschem goy godol, I'll make you into a great nation, Ba'barachacho, I will bless you, and I will make you very famous, Ve'yebracha, and you'll be a blessing. Now imagine a person who has all of this potential, and where he's situated, he can't develop it. Is it natural for him to move to another situation, another place where he can develop all that potential that's sitting inside him, rather than have it go to waste? For him, that's natural. You know, you have great violinists who practice the violin 16 hours a day. Very few people can do that. But for him, it's natural, because he has great talent, because he's very focused, because he has great endurance. So for him, it's natural. For other people, it's not natural. I don't see why nature would have to be the same for everybody. Yeah.
Do we say this is a test for Abraham?
Sure, it's a test.
So, I mean, if it was natural, that he would have wanted to do it, how much
was the test? You just stuck in two words, right? That he would want to do it. I didn't say it's natural that he would want to do it. In the same way in which a believer in macrobiotic diets will say to you, it is natural for the human being to eat macrobiotic food and not the junk that comes out of the factories. And you may study it, and you may come to feel that that's indeed correct. That doesn't mean you want to eat that mealy, you know, stuff which is so unappetizing and filled with bacteria because it sits on the shelf for 3 weeks and so on and so on. You know, it doesn't mean you want to do it. It is natural, but you don't want to do it. Take exercise. Your muscles were made to be used, not to be couch potatoes. Doesn't mean that you'll enjoy the exercise necessarily. Yeah.
Your point on Rambam was lost to me, and I don't understand what you're saying about to be weary of. What were you saying, being weary about the Rambam, or be weary about sources? Or
to be weary of drawing the conclusion that because he wrote X, that's what he believed.
Because that he wrote X is what he believed.
Right.
I don't know what that means. I know that Rambam specifically wrote himself, but, kind of contradicts what your point was, that if he had a choice to write before the ignoramus that everyone would understand, or just his peers, basically, or like a lead scholar, he would choose to write for the scholar.
But he didn't do that. In the commentary on the Mishnah, he was writing for ignoramus. Read it. In the introduction to Zvachim, you have to introduce him to all the basic laws of the sacrifices. This guy doesn't know anything about it. So he has to write out a whole long introduction of these matters. He's writing for ignoramus.
It's an overview of everything.
He's writing. No, I'm talking about the Mishnah Torah. I'm talking about the commentary in the Mishnah. The commentary in the Mishnah was written in Arabic.
Yeah.
Was written in Hebrew, because it was written for people who couldn't read Hebrew.
Right.
All right, that was the vernacular.
So you weren't saying that about the Mishnah Torah?
The Mishnah Torah was written for a person who could not derive laws from the Talmud. He says that in the introduction.
So it's basically Amharic?
Correct. That's right. He knows a lot, but he's not sophisticated enough to figure out what the law is. Correct.
So what does that mean when Rambam said, you know what I'm talking about? The where he writes about how
a thousand fools die and one person knows the truth, something like that. A thousand fools make a mistake and one person knows the truth.
Yes, yes. That he wrote in respect to the guy to the perplexed. But that doesn't mean he would never write anything for fools. He wrote a lot of things for ignorance.
That was like the exact opposite.
Well, I'm just telling you what he wrote. Those are the facts. You can't gainsay the fact. But even in the guide, he indicates that what he really wants to communicate is hidden. It's hidden. He says he put contradictions in for various reasons. And you have to be careful and notice the contradictions. He says, in the introduction, I'm not going to quit. He said, there are seven reasons why you find contradictions in books. And almost all of them are matters of incompetence. And then he says, sometimes you'll have two items, A and B, each one of which can only be understood in the light of the other one. So how do you ever get started? You're going to write A so that you'll have A on board to explain B, but you don't have B on board to explain A. So he said, al korchach, against your will, you start to write A, and write A in a way in which it's not going to be understood correctly, because you don't have B on board. Then you write B, and then you go back and rewrite A in the light of B. But now, he says, if you see A the first time and A the second time, you're going to think it's a contradiction. I'm telling you, it's not a contradiction. It's just how it has to be rewritten once you have B on board. And he says, in my book, if you find contradictions, that's the only reason. There's always a mistake in the introduction. Right? So, but he doesn't write those passages in red ink. You know, here comes A again. So, you know, back on page 52, and now it's page 361. So you should know that it's A. He doesn't do that. He just talks and talks and talks and talks. And you're supposed to figure out that it's the same thing again, and it looks like a contradiction. So you've got to figure out what the B was in between, and figure out why he had to say it that way, why he says it this way. That means it's going to take a lot of work to figure out what he really means.